You know, there's no real place like the Psalms to give voice to some of the thoughts that you may not be willing to voice to other people. One of those thoughts that you find repeated again and again throughout the Psalms is very simple. The statement that God doesn't see, that God doesn't know. On the one hand, it's put on the lips of those whose intent is to pursue sin and the indulgence of their flesh. And the reason that they do it is because they conclude that God doesn't really see, or that there is no God at all who's watching over them. You can hear it, for example, in Psalm 10. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. For the wicked boast of the desires of his soul, and the one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. In pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. Later on, as he's talking about these pursuits of the wicked, he notes in verse 11 that the wicked says in his heart, God has forgotten, he's hidden his face, he will never see it. See, these are the statements that you may not want to voice, but you think in your heart and mind. You think that, yeah, everyone's sort of playing this game on the outside, but God doesn't really exist, or God doesn't really see. And so you go about your life operating based off of the conventions of the world, the wisdom of the world, the pathways of the world, all based off of that same assumption. And by the way, it's not just the wicked. We're also presented in the Psalms with the righteous who find themselves sometimes concluding the same thing. For example, in Psalm 73, the righteous is wailing because the wicked seem to be advancing. They seem to be prospering in their way, and they seem to have no pain in their life, no troubles along the way. And they say, according to Psalm 73, how can God know, and is there knowledge in the Most High? For these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. There he's giving voice to the same thought, but from a different perspective. The thought that you may not want to voice to other people, but you think it. God doesn't really know. Or does he see? Does he really even pay attention to the things that are going on if he's there at all? See, both the righteous and the wicked are sometimes tempted to have that conclusion because of the world around them, because they see what's going on around them, and they see life and society and nations. They see them taking their course of action wherever they will, and so many times set against not only the principles of God, but the people of God, and against God himself. They see the arrogant boasting, and they see the people rejecting, and they see that there's no suffering, there's no consequence for what they're doing, and so in their hearts, quietly, they begin to wonder, does God even know? Well, this morning we come back to Matthew, our study of Matthew, and we find ourselves in Matthew chapter 26. And in a way, we find ourselves in a collision of perhaps these two perspectives. A collision between the arrogant who are defying God and the righteous who are devoted to God. And without really voicing it, we can kind of assume that they're operating off of these principles, that whatever they're doing and however they're displaying themselves, they're probably wondering if God is even taking notice, and some of them probably assuming that he's not. This is a study in Matthew chapter 26 of contrasts. Contrast between two different types of people. On one hand, it's the tragic story of Judas, the arch betrayer, the one who for all time has become the definition of a defector and a traitor in his betrayal of Jesus Christ. On the other hand, you have the backdrop of one of the most beautiful stories of love and affection for Christ from one of the most unassuming and maybe unknown disciples of Jesus Christ along the way. By all outward appearances, Judas would have been very privileged. He would have been just like all the other disciples along with Jesus for the last 3 years. He would have had access to the things that Jesus taught. He would have seen all the things that Jesus did. He, as I said, by all outward appearances, would have obeyed and followed the Lord, even loved the Lord. But we find at the end that it all proved to be spurious and false and superficial, because Matthew 26 tells the sad tale of his lost love for the Lord. And we've all felt and seen that in our own lives as we've watched friends and families and colleagues, after some time of profession, fall away from the Lord and prove themselves to be a betrayer. But it's not the full story here. It's not even really the biggest story, because in spite of all that rebellion and betrayal that is there by Judas, what we see is that the Lord was using that along with other things to work out a greater plan for his glory and for the redemption of his people. And even within this context, he was using the unassuming and perhaps unaware actions of some of his other disciples, one disciple in particular named Mary, who herself was pursuing the Lord in sincerity and in truth, and without knowing it, participating in a grander plan that the Lord had for his redemption, for the redemption, I should say, of his people. In the midst of it all, as the moment approaches for Jesus to be handed over and to be crucified, he's fully aware of the sovereign plan of God. He's not wondering and asking if God is seeing any of this or God knows any of this. He knows. He knows that God is seeing, God knows, God is registering, God remembers, God understands all of it. The devotion and the deception, the superficial faith and the faithful believer. He's well aware of both those realities as not necessarily contradicting, but complementing what God was at work doing in his life. He has reached this point of his ultimate mission, which is to offer himself on the cross for the redemption of God's people. And he fully understands as he approaches that, no matter what the world is thinking around him, no matter how things seem to be unfolding around him, he understands that through the schemes of his enemies and through the sincere love of his disciples, through the betrayal of Judas and even the weakness of the apostles, under all of that, the sovereign plan of God is bringing together his purpose to his ultimate victory. Now that's what we see unfolding before us in Matthew chapter 26 this morning, and in what are really three scenes of God's divine plan, or we might say God directing his divine plan through three scenes on the build-up to the cross, bringing about his purposes, and along the way here in Matthew, setting in contrast the final days, these two different perspectives, these two different approaches, these two different, you might say, reactions to everything that's happening around Jesus Christ, but all of them operating under the sovereignty of God. Now, pay attention to that just as I maybe read this for us in Matthew chapter 26, beginning in verse 1. It says, "When Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples, 'You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified.' Then the chief priests and the elders and the people gathered in the place of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. Now, when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at the table. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor. But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you trouble the woman? For she's done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment on my body, she has done it to prepare me for burial. For truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what will you give me if I deliver him over to you? And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him. A few different scenes here, three of them, in fact, where you can see God directing his divine plan towards the cross in the final days of Christ. The first one in verses 1 through 5, you see God's providence allowing a plot against Jesus Christ. This is Matthew placing it right after his Olivet Discourse. He says very plainly in verse 1, when Jesus had finished these sayings. Now that is not only a temporal note, it's also sort of a thematic note throughout Matthew's gospel. In fact, you'll find that saying or something very similar to that at the end of all five of the major discourses in Matthew's gospel. All of them are sort of hinges or transitions at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, for example, or the discourse on discipleship in chapter 10, or the kingdom parables in chapter 13, or the discourse on stumbling and forgiveness in chapter 18, or now here at the Olivet Discourse. At the end of each one of them, there is some summary statement, now when Jesus finished, or when Jesus finished these things. And so this is certainly framing up for Matthew his overall structure of the gospel, but it's also helping us to place this in terms of time, a conversation that Jesus was having with his disciples. He said to them, you know that after 2 days, the Passover's coming and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. This is also repeated 4 times in Matthew's gospel. He's telling them, or he has been telling them over and over again, that this is coming, that he knew from the very beginning that his fate was to be delivered up and to be crucified. And each time he tells it, he adds some particular detail to it. In this particular case, he's adding the detail of the timing, that it's going to come in 2 days on the Passover day. Now, just in broad strokes, this would have been critical for him to say at this point, because he had just finished on the side of the Mount of Olives. He had just finished telling them about his glorious return when he was going to be seated on his throne judging the nations. He was going to be the one who was separating the sheep from the goats and the righteous from the unrighteous. And he was going to be the one who was doling out the punishments for eternity. And so they might have been swept up and carried away with the idea that this was just triumph that was all ahead of them. So he immediately pulls them aside to remind them of what he has been saying from the beginning. This is not a direct course to glory. Before this glorification, there is going to be a humiliation. And it's going to involve a cross, and it's going to involve my crucifixion and my death, and it's all going to take place in 2 days, or we might say the day after tomorrow, because he's saying this to them on Wednesday. And of course, Thursday will be the institution of the Lord's Supper, and then Friday would be the Passover day, the day when they slaughtered all of the lambs in Jerusalem on the day of the Passover. This was, of course, a major feast in Israel's calendar. This was the major feast, you might say. It launched a whole week of festival, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But the first day of that was the Passover day, the day designated to commemorate, you might say, the founding of Israel, but more specifically to commemorate God's deliverance of Israel from slavery, from bondage. And this was the day when they slaughtered the lambs and they painted the blood on the lintels of the doorways in order to remind themselves of how God had delivered them from bondage. And it would have been a day when people would have made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. They would have absolutely swarmed the city. They would have brought their lambs or purchased their lambs along the way, and they would have all been slaughtered on that day. Josephus tells us more than 200,000 lambs sometimes were slaughtered in the temple on that one day. 200,000 lambs. It was a day of bleeding and bleeding, we might say. A day when goats were screaming and priests were bloodied from sunup to sundown. And Jesus is telling his disciples, this is what's going to happen. I am going to be delivered up, and I am going to die, and it's going to be on that day. Why? Because this is the day God has determined. Because this is the day God has ordained. He's ordained whenever he established the Passover from the very beginning. He has ordained that the lambs that were slaughtered would never be sufficient in order to remove the sin of people. Just like every other religious ceremony, just like every other sacrifice, it would never be sufficient to satisfy the demands of God. But he was going to provide a lamb, and that was his Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ, who was going to be the Passover lamb, and he was going to be sacrificed on the Passover day, and it was going to be satisfactory for all the demands of God's law, so that everyone who ever trusts in Christ would have their sins totally forgiven. And Jesus is telling them very plainly that this is exactly what God has ordained. This is exactly what's going to happen. This is what I've been telling you all along. Now, while Jesus is telling his disciples that, around the same time, not necessarily that same hour, but certainly that week, the chief priest and the elders had gathered in the courtyard of Caiaphas, the high priest, in order to foment a scheme, a plan, a plot to arrest and to kill Jesus. Now, these, of course, were the supposed spiritual leaders of Israel. They were the ones who were supposed to be pointing the people of God to their Messiah. They were the ones who were supposed to be exhibiting righteous behavior. They were supposed to be the ones who were honoring God and submitting to him and to his word and to his will. But they had been overtaken by personal ambition, by greed, by a lust for power and influence and wealth. And now, because of the popularity of Jesus Christ, they were feeling threatened in all of that. And so they have decided that they're going to try to eliminate him. They're going to eliminate him for one reason, because he had gone into the temple earlier that day and had denounced them and had called out their hypocrisy and their ungodliness and exposed them in front of all the people. And so they were still smarting, if you will, from that kind of public rebuke from Jesus Christ. And so they had decided that he must die. But secondly, they were just simply afraid that the Romans were going to come and they were going to see Jesus leading some sort of rebellion, and that as a result of that, the Romans were going to forcibly remove them for failure to lead or failure to keep the peace or whatever it might be. In fact, this same group of priests, we're told in John 11, verse 47, we're saying to one another, this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So they were fearful that all of this was going to lead to the loss of their position and their power and their influence and their wealth. In other words, it really wasn't about theological differences. They weren't exercising their spiritual oversight in that sense. This was about political influence, political position. The old adage says, where fear leads, wisdom cannot follow. And that's exactly what you see happening here. A group of leaders who are trying to lead out of fear. And that's never a recipe for good leadership. They're fearful. Fearful primarily for themselves because they had become a corrupt group full of greed and ambition and avarice. And the role that they were designed to have, which is to serve God's people, to uphold righteousness, to point people to Christ, had become a twisted instrument for their own personal gain. And so they're plotting. But Matthew says they want to do it when it's safe. That's their conclusion in verse 5. Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. They understood that Jerusalem, during the Passover feast, had swollen from what was probably normally their population of 40 or 50,000, had swollen to over 2 million people in most instances. The whole nation conglomerated on the hills and the valleys all around Jerusalem, sleeping on the hillsides and in the tents and any kind of spare place that they could find. And so there was an enormous crowd that was volatile and unmanageable. They didn't have the resources to be able to manage that kind of a riot if it were to break out. And on top of that, many of the people had come down from Galilee and they had probably witness and follow Jesus for some amount of time and might have had some sort of local loyalty to him because of what they saw from him. As a matter of fact, back in chapter 21, verse 46, you may remember, it says that they were seeking to arrest him, but they feared the crowds because they held him to be a prophet. So there was some level of reverence or respect from the crowds that they were aware of. They saw the triumphal entry back on Monday whenever he entered the city and people were taking the coats off their backs and throwing them on the dirt to make a royal pathway for Jesus to walk on or for the donkey to walk on that was carrying him. They saw the people flocking to the temple the next day to hear him dialoguing and correcting the scribes and Pharisees and priests. They saw the crowds returning again on Wednesday to hear his great message when he was denouncing the hypocrisy of the scribes and Pharisees. They understood that there was sort of a danger to all this. And so they concluded that they're going to try to do this afterward, after the Passover, after the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Once it was all over and once all the people had dispersed, they had determined that they were going to arrest and seize Jesus. But you know what? Even their plotting, they weren't in control of. God had a different plan. God had determined that Jesus was going to die when? On the Passover. The very thing they didn't want to happen. He would die at the moment that they feared the most. During the festival, they determined not to do anything in front of the crowds that they were afraid of, all in fulfillment of God's perfect plan, because their schemes could not alter the divine plan of God. They wanted to kill him, but they wanted to do it in the safest possible way for themselves. But they're going to learn that if Jesus was going to die, it's going to be voluntary. It's going to be not them taking his life, but him giving his life. It's going to be, as he says in another place, no one taking my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. Their schemes, no matter what they are going to operate according to God's time frame. and his will would not be thwarted, and it wouldn't be dictated by their timing or their plan, but according to God's plan. In the Passover, the time when God demanded a sacrifice in celebration of their deliverance and in anticipation of a greater deliverance from their sin, that was going to be the time when God wanted his sacrifice, the Messiah, to be crucified on the cross. And of course, his will prevail. So you can't outmaneuver God. You may imagine yourself so clever and so well prepared and so knowledgeable and so skillful and so whatever. You might imagine that you're operating in this environment where you're pulling all the levers and you're controlling all the pathways and you're doing all the things that you think you can do or want to do, and then God isn't paying attention or God isn't doing any of it at all, but you can't outmaneuver God. He is in control whether you want to acknowledge it or not. And these leaders, unfortunately, rather than making themselves the objects of God's grace and benefit by yielding to Christ, they have left themselves nothing more than to just be the pawns in his plan. A plan that he's working out for his own glory and for the benefit of his own people. But God's going to work regardless of them in the way that he wants to work. Now, Matthew tells us all that, and then he immediately introduces a second scene, which for some people might appear to be disjointed or out of place, but it's another scene, whether you recognize it or not, that helps us to understand how God is directing his divine plan for the cross, this time through a woman named Mary. As you see in verse 16, Christ's memorial magnifying her devotion. Matthew introduces it in verse 6. Now, when Jesus was at Bethany, which might give you the impression that this happened maybe that same day or that same night or whatever, but it's actually a little bit of a flashback to the previous Saturday night when there had been a big dinner held in the village of Bethany. That was a small village that was over the Mount of Olives and across another valley. And Jesus was staying there during his final week in Jerusalem. He was staying at the home of Lazarus and his two sisters, Mary and Martha. But when he arrived in Jerusalem on a Friday night, and they rested the next day on the Sabbath, after sundown on that Saturday night, that Sabbath night, when the Sabbath was over, there was another man in the town named Simon the leper who wanted to hold a meal, a feast for Jesus. Now, we presume that this is because he had been healed. This is a man who was known as Simon the leper and apparently no longer leprous because he couldn't have had people in his home. He couldn't have eaten a meal with people if he was still leprous. He would have had to be separated from the community. So this is a man who was previously a leper, and of course there was no cure for leprosy, so the only way he could have been cured was by the hand of Christ. So he wants to hold this meal and give thanks to the Lord and celebrate this and maybe introduce his friends to this man who had changed his life. And we're told that while he's there, that at the same time, Mary and Martha and Lazarus also attended the meal. And it's actually John in John chapter 12 who tells us that it's Mary who is this otherwise unnamed woman who comes into the room that night with this very expensive alabaster vial of perfume. Matthew brings all of this in by way of contrast now. Contrast to the treachery and the scheming of these so-called religious leaders who should have been pointing people to Jesus, who should have been honoring and anointing him. Matthew presents this beautiful picture of Mary doing what these leaders should have done. On the one hand, you have the scheming leaders paralyzed by the fear of the crowds and what they may do to them. On the other hand, you have this extravagant outpouring of love and affection from Mary who faces all the criticism of everyone in the room, but doesn't care. She has more courage, more honor, more spiritual insight and discernment than all the leaders of Israel. On the one hand, you have deceit. On the other hand, you have devotion. On one hand, you have the ugliness of self-centered pride and all the concern about holding on to position and esteem and influence and no doubt possessions. On the other hand, you have a woman who's willing to endure shame, willing to pour out one of her most costly possessions in an effort to try to show some proper honor to Jesus. By the way, this is expensive stuff that she's bringing in. We're told by Mark that it was a pound of nard. That was the perfume that she brought. It was a plant or an ointment that came from the nard plant, which only grows in the Himalaya mountains from 7,000 to 10,000 feet above sea level. So whoever harvested this stuff had to climb up the mountain and had to harvest it and bring it back down and then export it from that area of what might have been called Persia or we know of as India today, exported it and brought it all the way over to Jerusalem, and it was expensive stuff. 300 denarii was its value, its approximate value, according to Mark, which was about 1 year's wage for an average worker. It would have been worth tens of thousands, if not $100,000 in today's economy. This was probably the most expensive thing that Mary owned. And all of it poured out on a single night. She didn't hold back. Mark says she broke the flask and poured it, Matthew says she broke the flask and poured it over his head. John adds that she poured it on his feet and wiped them with her hair. Now, this flask would have had a tiny hole, a little weep hole that had been pierced at the top in order for you to pour out one drop at a time because this is so precious a stuff. She just broke the whole flask and dumped the whole thing out on Jesus. Didn't hold back. You know, this is extravagance on just an unspeakable level. People do extravagant things. We understand that. King Henry VIII, we're told, had this extravagant festival whenever he hosted the King of France that's known as the Gold Cloth Feast. Because they put up tents that were coated in gold. And they set tablecloths that were made out of pure silk. And they constructed fountains on site that were filled with the finest of wine. And they decked themselves out in their finest of jewels just to come together in order to put on a display to their own honor and to try to outdo one another as two kings of two opposing nations. But all of it, not only to honor themselves, but to indulge themselves. But that's not what Mary's doing. This has nothing to do with her own indulgence or her own honor or anything. That's what you might expect of somebody when they are displaying extravagance. But this is not about Mary at all. This is about her love for the Lord. It is an extravagant display of devotion as well as a incredible display of courage and selfless love. And it was a shock to everybody in the room. Mary was, I'm sure, fully aware of the cost as she broke the jar and poured it over Jesus' head and feet, holding nothing back. The question really most people ask is, why did she do this? And what was her motive? And we're not really told in here. It's possible that she was just remembering that Jesus, a few weeks earlier, had raised her brother from the dead. Lazarus had been raised from the dead in John chapter 11, and that was Mary's brother. And maybe this was just out of a gratitude for that. She understood that Jesus had done something in her family for her brother and couldn't find adequate words to say thank you. But there seems to be more than just that. There seems to be some sense of urgency, some sense of time that's involved with this, because that's how Jesus winds up commending her. The people in the room start to grumble and criticize as all this is unfolding, and they're grumbling about Mary's actions and talking about what a huge waste this is, squandering these resources, which they said could have been sold and given to the poor. In fact, John says it was Judas who spoke up and gave voice for everybody in the room, and he was the one who was vocalizing these criticisms. But John says that he said this not because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and he had charge of the money bag and he used to help himself to whatever was put within it. So Judas, at least, was involved with this criticism, but all of his thinking and all of his motives were worldly in their calculation. But here they are criticizing Mary over this. And instead, they're the ones who wind up getting rebuked by Jesus. He says to them in verse 10, "Why do you trouble the woman? For she's done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. And in pouring out the ointment on my body, she's done it to prepare me for burial." Jesus is just saying this woman is sensitive to the time. She's sensitive to the time. He's making a contrast, obviously, with the ministry to the poor, the things that might have been done, all those things that Jesus doesn't deny are reasonable and viable in their own place and time. But they're not the ultimate, and they're certainly not the priority in the life of a believer or in their worship of God. And Mary particularly understands something about the time. You always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. This is the calculation that Mary is making, according to Jesus. We don't know if she has clued in to some of the words that he's been trying to say. Maybe she overheard him even say that in 2 days he was going to die, but at the very least, she probably sensed that there was a growing animosity from the leaders and that the dangers were rising along the way. And so Jesus frames all this up for the disciples. This is a woman who is being governed not by the values of the world around her, not by the values of the disciples, not by the values of the priest and the scribes, not even by the value of the things that she owns. She was governed by the value of Jesus Christ. Or we might say it this way, she's asking completely different questions than everyone else. The disciples were seeing all this and they were asking, well, how much did that cost? She was doing all this and she was asking, how long do I have? How long do I have? It wasn't how much do I give, but how much time do I have to do this for my Lord? The days are coming. The time is short. And she doesn't want to have anything left over in the tank. She wants to make sure that before Jesus is gone or before even her life is over or whatever it might be, she wants to make sure that she's done everything that she can do in order to serve the Lord. And she has this opportunity right in front of her. He's in her village. He's in her town. The people are there. She's able to make this extravagant thing. And so she seizes this opportunity. And because of all that, Jesus honors her. He says in verse 13, "Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." He's just recognizing that this woman, unlike any of his apostles, unlike any of the other men in the room, she is the one who discerned these priorities. Remember, Mary was the one who previously, when Jesus visited their home, left aside the domestic duties, was willing, presumably, to take the criticism of being a poor hostess. Why? So that she could sit at the feet of Christ and listen. What did Jesus say? She chose the better part. She's always, this Mary, always choosing the better part. She's just seemed, among all of his disciples, to have her spiritual priorities right. And because of all that, Jesus says she, her story, her life is going to be told generation after generation. Her life preached a sermon that's more memorable than the greatest orators and the greatest preachers of all time because of how she loved Christ. In some ways, it's almost more remarkable because of how in those days women didn't count for much in the eyes of men, at least, or in the eyes of society. But here's a woman who has given a unique place in gospel history. Just like later on, she'll be the first one or one of the first ones to actually see the resurrected Christ. And because of that, she, along with a few other ladies, will have the privilege of being the very first ones to proclaim the resurrection of Christ. Not the apostles, not the other disciples, but Mary and her friends. This is a remarkable woman. And Jesus says, because of that, her life's going to be remembered far beyond her. Now, all this contrasts not just to the scheming priest, but more particularly, it contrasts to Judas, who's the focus of the last scene here. In verse 14 through 16, Judas's betrayal revealing his blindness to all of this. In contrast to Mary's devotion, here you have Judas with this staggering and sobering betrayal. Judas, who, by the way, had just criticized Mary's act for pouring out this expensive perfume, for giving everything that she had in worship of Christ, Judas is ready to hand him over for 30 pieces of silver. That's his price. We read in verse 14, then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priest and he says, "What will you give me if I deliver him over to you?" And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him. Now, 30 pieces of silver is not a lot. It was probably about a month of salary in those days. Not a lot. Maybe 2 months, some people speculate. But compared to the act of what he did, there's no comparison. This is a man, unlike Mary, who is remembered throughout all the world because she was one of the supreme devoted disciples of Christ. This is a man who will forever be known for his treachery and his cowardice and his betrayal. This probably happened, by the way, right after the dinner, most likely, because he was still smarting from the rebuke that he had received, and maybe more than that, he was calculating that whatever he had hoped to receive by participating in this movement with Jesus wasn't going to probably pan out the way he wanted it to. Jesus was going to squander all the resources. Jesus was going to give away all the cash. He wasn't going to be able to enrich himself the way he thought he was. And on top of that, he probably wasn't going to be successful anyway. So this is a guy who had been one of the 12. That's what Matthew says about him. He was one of the 12, meaning that he had all the access, all the privilege, day and night for 3 years, sitting and listening to Jesus teach, watching him heal people, watching him multiply food miraculously, watching him walk on water for 3 years. He saw all of this. I mean, you couldn't have had a more rich spiritual heritage than what he had. He was in the richest spiritual environment, the best sort of church fellowship or whatever you might want to compare it to, the best place that he could possibly be to be exposed to the truth of God and the richness of Christ. And yet still, all of that grace was nothing because it wasn't saving grace. It was just temporal mercies. Temporal mercies that in the end were squandered. Matthew also calls him Judas, who was called Iscariot, which means he was from the village of Kerioth. That's what Iscariot means. It was a small village south of Jerusalem. He was actually the only apostle who was not from Galilee. He was from the south of Israel, which meant that he had a whole network of relationships and friends that the other apostles didn't have, which also meant that he was able to work some back channels of communication without the threat of any of the other guys hearing about it. And that's exactly what he does. He goes to the chief priest and he makes his effort to get his cash, to cash in for the best he can on this whole Christ thing. And the price is 30 pieces of silver, which, by the way, is exactly what Jeremiah 11 says is going to be the price for the Messiah. 30 pieces of silver. Another display of God's sovereign hand at work in this whole situation. God working all these things together, the treachery of the leaders, the betrayal of Judas, the quiet and unassuming devotion of Mary. Every one of them at some point were probably saying to themselves, God probably doesn't see this. God probably doesn't know. God's not really watching. He's not really watching my little life and the sacrifices I make. God's not really watching the sins that I pursue. But he was, and he was directing, and he was steering it all for his own purposes. Even Judas, who we're told that Satan had put it into his heart to do this. In John 13, during the Last Supper, the devil having already put in the heart of Judas Iscariot to betray him. So before the Last Supper ever happened, Satan already put it into Judas's heart. Well, how did that happen? I mean, you're around Jesus all the time. How did Satan do this? Well, guess what? I mean, that's no guarantee that Satan has no access to your heart. Just because you are brought up in a Christian home or married to a Christian spouse or in a Christian church every Sunday, that's no guarantee that Satan can't touch you. Satan put it into Judas's heart. And while we're never told exactly how that happened, we have a clue by what's unfolding right in front of us, because Judas was consumed with greed. He was consumed with greed. He used to pilfer the money bag. He's going out and selling information and even access to Jesus. He was set off, if you will, by Mary's sacrifice, hoping that he would somehow be able to pilfer from even her. And now, being willing to sell out Jesus for this paltry sum. Greed drove this man to open the door of his heart to Satan. It's not surprising to us because Paul says greed is idolatry in Ephesians chapter 5. It's another God. It's another God that you can be worshiping even while you're supposedly worshiping the true God, that you can be worshiping even while you're sitting listening to Bible lessons and Bible stories and sermons and all those other things from whoever, the best teachers in the world, Christ himself. And yet you can give Satan an avenue into your heart through greed. So opposite from Mary, isn't it? This is so profound, really. This man who had all these privileges that in some ways Mary didn't even have, and yet he fell away, giving himself over to the work of the enemy. And yet again, it's all part of God's plan. Jesus says at another point, the Son of Man is going as it has been determined by God, but woe to the man by whom he's betrayed. God's even using his betrayal, his disloyalty, his defection for divine purposes, for his own glory, for the redemption of his own people. So it doesn't matter, the plots, the scheming, all the stuff, whatever they're supposedly going through, whatever plans they're hatching, they're not going to outsmart God. God's going to do what he intends to do regardless of you. You just have the choice. You can either be the unwitting and unbenefiting pawn, or you can be the devoted disciple. You can either be the Judas or the priest or whatever, or you can be Mary. Just making your sacrifices, just pouring out your perfume, your ointment, your service, your whatever. Maybe asking, does God even see this stuff that I'm doing? He sees. He sees it, and he is using it to prepare his kingdom in ways that you may not even be aware of. And he's making it so that all those deeds are known eternally. This woman's name is known wherever the gospel is preached, but every one of these deeds is remembered by our sovereign God, who's bringing about his purpose and his redemption regardless of all opposition. Lord, what a sweet, sweet reminder for us this morning. We are so overwhelmed by the pictures that are presented to us on the pages of Matthew. How ignorant we can be. How so slow in our faith to think that you are overlooking even the minor details, or that you're forgetting the schemes and the plotting of the arrogant deceivers and deniers around us. You're not. You are not. You're bringing all these things together for the good of your people and the glory of your kingdom. I pray that we would walk away from here today profoundly struck by that truth and prepared because of it to seize the moment that we have, to think about eternity the way Mary did, to assess our lives not based on what the cost might be, but based on the opportunity and the time. How much time do we have in this life and with the things that we have to make an impact for you? You're deserving of all of it. Every ounce, every bit of energy and time and resource that we have, you are deserving. I pray that you would make us like Mary. We ask in Christ's name. Amen.